So to summarise then what I've talked about in episodes 1 and 2 so far, I conclude that leasehold abuse is nothing more than theft. Theft of your finances, theft of your resources, but ultimately theft of your estate, either directly or indirectly. And I will go on to talk about and furnish you with more examples, examples aplenty, in fact. But before I dive into the pool of experiences I've come across and witnessed personally, I just want to talk to you a little bit about crime in part 3. And I hope you don't think I'm going off topic here, because I promise you this will all come back to leasehold in the most natural of ways, because it's absolutely all connected. In episode 1, I talked about the top 3 human motivations being those of power, money, sex. But where does crime fit into this, I hear you ask? Well, essentially, all crime is theft. We appear to live in a society of people stealing from each other. Stealing each other's money, each other's possessions, each other's land, and each other's property. I think worst of all, the worst crime of all is theft of life. I mean, the list goes on, doesn't it? The most modern form of theft is identity. But people will take anything, even partners, if they have the opportunity. The bottom line is, if somebody else has got it, guaranteed somebody else will want to take it, whether they've earned it or not. So really, there are no limits to what someone will take from someone else, and most, if not all theft, would be considered criminal. And again, bringing it back to World War II and focusing on the motivations of Hitler, which you'll find I do quite a bit in this podcast, who incidentally was a socialist first and foremostly, decided that with inflation at an all-time unsustainable high, and one that was spiralling out of control with nominal levels of employment and the opportunity to make a living very, very slim pickings indeed, he decided that he wanted a slice of the pie. So the easiest thing for him to do was try and get himself into a position of power whereby he could just take what he wanted from those who did have. And those who did have were the very industrial, entrepreneurially driven and work ethic oriented sector of society that he knew of, who were indeed known as the Jews. It's no secret the Jews were the original moneylenders. You'll see signs of that today, and of course the surnames very often give it away, with either gold or diamond forming part, if not all, of the surname. Well, of course that got under his skin, but really to the extreme, and to an extreme that had never been seen before. Of course, theft is and always has been illegal. Since biblical times, it's been number 8 in the top 10 commandments charts of thou shalt not steal. And if you're interested in finding out more about those 10 must not do's, there's a link in the podcast notes. But where would the approach of theft alone have left Hitler? Well, not in a great position, quite honestly. But would it have mattered if he exterminated along the way? The answer to that is clearly no. And again, what was World War II about? Well, it was first and foremostly about land theft and resource theft. But cut to today's world, whereby daily ads tell you that fraud is getting more sophisticated, and I quote that verbatim. Whilst that might be true, that's only describing one end of the scale. The other end of the scale is that fraud exists right underneath your very nose for all to see, and it's as explicit as business as usual. Certainly to the victim. However, it's condoned to the extent it's almost impossible to prove, and certainly irrelevant in a civil court responsible for governing and managing the respective leasehold framework. And in my experience, that's certainly the case in the FTT. And for those of you who don't know, the FTT is the civil court, first-tier tribunal property chamber, who handle applications, appeals and references relating to disputes over property and land. I'll pop a link to the respective government webpage in the podcast notes. And that's the difference between the top and the bottom, isn't it? The top get away with financial homicide through loosely defined, unchallengeable law that is riddled with grey areas, and correlating that to the area of property, it's ultimately enabling landowners, their management companies and associates to operate with impunity. Insert Frederick Bastiat's statement here. And for those of you who didn't catch it in episode 1, Frédéric Bastiat was an 18th century French economist who said, "When plunder becomes a way of life for a group of men in a society, over time they create for themselves a legal system that authorises it and a moral code that glorifies it. So that's the top. And at the bottom, although I caveat this by stating it's also seeping into the middle tier, well, they get away with the crime of theft generally because they're almost impossible to track down or trace. They operate underground. And even when you do catch up with them, it has to be proven. They have to be caught in the act. A relevant and more recent example, illustrating just what I'm talking about, was the Codebreak sting of 2020. I'll pop a link to a news article on this in the podcast notes, but essentially this was a £54 million phone hacking scandal pertaining to money laundering, ammunitions, human trafficking and drugs. The article reveals almost 750 were arrested, all from different backgrounds, some even police officers. And with the more recently publicised police scandals, it's not too hard to believe. But this definitely brings to life and supports my theory that the middle tier taxpayer, call it the middle class, call it what you want, goes looking to the top and the bottom in search of financial solutions to their problems and alternative mechanisms to secure easy money and ride on their coattails. And my belief is that we start to see more of this type of crime when government starts to take too much in the form of taxes, or they present the imposition of other equally unaffordable costs or penalties on earnings, and so on and so forth. And I'll come on to talk about the part government plays with taxation, its substantial and far-reaching extent, and the attitudes towards money in a later episode. But let's face it, the top can't survive without the bottom, and the bottom can't survive without the top. But what we're seeing more and more is the middle tier nominating themselves to be the facilitators of those connections. And I'll go on more to talk about war and side switching in part four. And the reason I cover this is because I've seen it come to life in leasehold and leasehold abuse. With all of what I've just spoken about in mind, to delineate, separate and disassociate financial crime and physical crime to such a degree that you have a civil legal justice framework governing a huge proportion of the construction, property and property management sector, which is exactly where leasehold sits, it's ultimately about all those dealing in land, is beyond incomprehensible to me. Do I even need to bring back Frédéric Bastiat's statement into play at this stage? I'd hope by now you're in the rhythm of what I'm getting at. In that same vein, the old saying, possession is 9/10 of the law, the definition of which I'll put a link to in the podcast notes, but essentially it's an expression meaning that ownership is easier to maintain if one has possession of something, or difficult to enforce if one does not. But what if people have gone about securing that possession in an illegal way? What if it's done illegally? Have they actually paid for something? Or have they just taken it? And how do you prove it? There appears to be a stratum of theft in the UK that has fast become commonplace. If you like, we can call it, label it, casual everyday theft, which constitutes casual everyday fraud. That's in essence legalised fraud. And that's exactly what Frédéric Bastiat talks of. With that in mind, and the notion that all theft is abuse of some kind, I am more than inclined to call a thief an abuser. And what's more, I always say an abuser's biggest fear is the fear of being found out, irrespective of the kind of abuse they're committing. What's interesting about that is that we have a legal justice system that goes out of its way to prevent and minimise disclosure surrounding abusers. I mean, that's what settlement agreements and NDAs are about, right? I've seen lawyers and barristers who make it their life's work to ensure their client's reputation goes unscathed, and that somehow it would be considered an outrage that their client, who in fact could well be an abuser, financial or otherwise, is far from it, and that any exposure to the contrary of their client's behaviour would be devastatingly damaging to them, and therefore their reputation would be in the gutter. And oh, by the way, they, the unexposed potential criminal, is entitled to and should be compensated for that. I mean, to give you a topical example, what would have happened had the post office scenario not been exposed? Well, the innocent would continue to be called out as the criminals, and those responsible would have continued to be called out as the innocent victims. That's what happens in the legal world, and that's what I'm talking about here, when the legal justice system gets it so wrong. I always say that just because you can't prove something, it doesn't mean that it's not happening. And I'll come on to talk a bit more about that and conspiracy theory in later episodes. But there used to be a saying to the tune of, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime. Well, more and more, what I'm seeing is that it seems to be a case of, well, do the crime and you'll likely get away with the time. So I wouldn't worry if I were you. And I think that that's where the legal justice system in itself has led us as a society. Let me illustrate what I mean. 30 years ago, and bear in mind I've had experience of the legal justice system spanning many years, you used to be able to say to somebody, you'll be hearing from my lawyer. And quite literally, your opponent would, and I don't know how else to put this, but they would quite literally crap themselves. But it's quite true. Down on planet average layman, whatever had been stolen from you would be returned. Any money that had been taken or was owed would be given back. You say that to somebody nowadays and they simply shrug their shoulders and say, "Meh, do your worst. You can't prove it." But what kind of a society do we live in where that's the case, whereby someone can believe that they can behave that way and get away with it, and that they are ultimately above the law? And really, this just illustrates the downward spiral we're on with the legal justice system. In my view, that's partly down to over-legislation. We appear to have a situation where law is mutating and impinging on other law, certainly with areas such as data protection, human rights, digital laws, and similar regulation. I know HR teams have, for example, and continue to be put through the ringer insofar as what they can and can't do for and on behalf of their organisations, certainly where hiring and firing is concerned. I do believe, though, that this has something to do with the difficulty on case law not being as cut and dried nowadays, whereby once you may have had several laws pertaining to and governing a particular subject matter, now there may be numerous areas of laws for consideration. I mean, the simplest illustration I can give is the Sixth Commandment, thou shalt not kill. Well, how many laws govern that subject area now? And maybe that is oversimplifying what I mean. But we live in a society whereby you have a legal justice system that states its default position is that you must have evidence, which is quite a genius statement of demand, really. However, what I find incredible about that is that we also have a legal justice system that goes out of its way to prevent you securing that evidence in the first place, with regulation like data protection laws, human rights laws, laws governing what you can and can't record or video, when and where you can and can't record. So how do you even prove that someone is a liar or a thief or a criminal nowadays anyway? And I mean, from my legal experience over the years, it would appear lawyers' default position and advice to their client quite simply is tell them they can't prove it. And over the decades, as litigation has become more accessible to the middle tier or middle class, you hear this statement echo and permeate throughout society. Of course, there are laws that dismiss those rules to some extent. In respect of recording, for example, if you believe someone's life's at risk, much of that rulebook goes out of the window. But that brings me back to the point as to why financial crime is dealt with any differently to any other kind of crime. If we bring it back to the top three human motivators, those of power, money, sex, then we need to ensure associated crimes are dealt with in exactly the same way. These three motivations are the reasons or byproduct behind each and every war, as I've said previously. If you had to order them in priority, power would always be at the top, because you don't necessarily need money to have power over somebody else to be able to abuse them. But by and large, they're inextricably linked. And of course, the motivation of sex or sexual abuse can be a byproduct of any crime whereby sex wasn't the primary motivation of the crime. Power or money were. And it's certainly the byproduct and casualty of each and every war. We've seen that throughout each and every war in history, even in today's world. So tell me again why we treat financial crime any differently to criminal activity generally, and where the boundaries are drawn with financial crime. And also, is stealing £5,000 different to stealing £5 million? Theft of £5,000 can happen repeatedly and over time. So why is it treated any differently? I guess the real question is, has it been proven to be financial crime? The answer to that, where leasehold is concerned, is largely no. But again, insert Frederick Bastiat's statement here, because this system, in my view, has ultimately been cultivated and designed so that it can be abused. So catch part 4, where I'll be talking more about human motivation and those who believe they're above the law a little bit more.